Well, welcome to Greek Club. We are broadcasting today from the Tower of Power here on the campus of Concordia Seminary, where we can see all the kingdoms of the world and their glory, but we are not seduced by them. We love the Word of God, which is written in Greek. And today, we are beginning a letter to the Hebrews, which I think in general has the reputation for being far and away the most sophisticated and difficult Greek in the New Testament. St. Luke has his moments, to be sure, as does St. Paul, but Hebrews is really, really hard at times, and so the rule for Hebrews is parse or die, because the word order will not help you at all, unlike the Synoptics or sometimes St. Paul.
Who is considered the author?
Yeah, good question, Dave. The question is, who is the author? And of course, the answer is nobody knows. And there's about four or five guesses. I think Barnabas's name comes up, and Apollos. I seem to recall that Luther thought that maybe Apollos might have written Hebrews. Of course, he's a prominent person who figures in Acts and is mentioned in 1 Corinthians, at least. So, we just simply don't know. It's anonymous. And it's not even a letter, you know, in the way that the other epistles are letters. Right? It just launches. There's no greeting. Right? At the end, there's a reference to Christians in Italy. But it just launches in with this sentence, which is one of the longest and most complicated sentences in the New Testament. It's called a periodic sentence. That's what the grammarians call it. And if you didn't think that Greek loved to subordinate constructions to main verbs before, well, buckle up, because we're about to get it. The author is unknown, and of course, in terms of its canonicity, Hebrews is sometimes categorized as anti-legomena, which means that some parts of the early church had somewhere had questions about its authenticity or its authority. But we won't get into all that nonsense, that good and important nonsense. We'll just parse here. We'll parse our brains out. And if I make a mistake, please correct me. All right, the first, the opening sentence is... Well, I guess it's verses 1 and 2, and so we can take that together. And right away we see some interesting... to be honest, I'm baffled by the English translations, if I can say it that way. But that'll come up in due course. So Hebrews 1, verse 1. Polymeros kai polytropos palai hatheas la lesas tois patrazen en tois prophetais ep eskatu ton hemeron tuton elalesen Hamin, enhuio, hun ethikin kleranamon ponton, dihu kai, epoiesen tus ionas. Now, the main verb of the sentence would be in the third line, elalesen, spoke. Right, it's from laleo, it's just an aorist indicative. So, and the subject is on the first line, God, right? So the main, in a sense, the spine of the sentence is God spoke, right? And in between that, you got a whole bunch of stuff. Now, we begin with two adverbs, which are typically translated in various ways and in many ways. Okay? And you could actually see that, you might remember that the omega sigma ending is kind of a typical adverbial ending in Greek. Palai is also an adverb, and it means long ago or formerly. And now look at lalesos at the end of the line. It's actually a participle. And so it's an attributive position, predicate position, and God is the referent. And for the life of me, I do not know why the English translations render it in many and various ways God spoke, but now he has spoken. I don't know why they don't translate it adverbially. After God, in many and various ways, spoke to the fathers in the prophets, he spoke to us in the Son. I mean, it's a dependent construction. It's not a coordinating independent clausal construction. And to be honest, I have no idea why the translations don't reflect it as like a temporal, probably a temporal participle. That's the way I would suggest actually translating it. After he had in many and various ways formerly spoken to the fathers. And now notice en tois prophetais. Again, here the English translations puzzle me a little bit. Often rendered by the prophets. See? And that's possible, but if you hash around in the grammars, it's en plus the dative can express personal agency, but very rarely and mostly with passive voice verbs. So I think in, either in connection with or in. God spoke. Now it was in the prophets that he spoke, but that's what was going on. And so also in the next clause, it's not he spoke to us by a son, but in a son. And of course, it's funny, every single word here is debated and discussed, especially when we get to verses 3 and following and all the Christology that's involved. We won't even wave at that. You know, we're just going to parse and translate a little bit. It's hard to avoid all of it, of course. So the first line and a half is, with the exception of hatheos, which is, actually goes with the main verb in the third line, that whole thing is a participle construction, right? Predicate position. Speaking of old in many and various ways to the fathers in the prophets, after speaking, now the other shoe drops. And we get the first little phrase there in verse 2, FP plus the genitive can have a temporal sense, in the time of. Okay, and that's how you get the translation, in the last of these days, or during the last of these days. He, God, spoke to us in a son, in the son. Right? And then we have the relative pronoun hun, right, which has son as antecedent. Whom? Now, esse ken, who can tell me what dictionary form that's from? That's our friend tithemi. It's not a perfect, although with the kappa in the stem you think it would be. It's actually just an aorist indicative. It goes tithemi theso esse ka, right? So that's just an aorist indicative. Whom he appointed to be, now we got the, so in this construction, hun is a direct object of ethiken, and then kleronomon is the complement, in an object complement, double accusative. Whom he appointed to be heir of all things, right? And I suppose that, you could probably, if you wanted to label it, call that a objective genitive. He inherits all things, right? Through whom, more modifying of the son, through whom also he, God, made the Ionoses. Now this is another puzzling thing to me, because I think the typical English translation is world. Right? But Ion can scarcely or barely mean world. It means age. Right?
Well, in Hebrew, the word for eternity, olam, oftentimes is rendered as earth or world.
Right. But I hashed around in the lexica a little bit. It's interesting, Liddell and Scott doesn't even give that as a possible gloss, world, anywhere in Greek literature. Now, Bedag does. But one of the points I was going to make, which is something of a theological point, is already in this opening sentence we have an eschatological framework established, because this is formerly and now in the last of these times, right? And God is the one through, and it's through the Son that he made the ages, right? So it's in a sense it's prophecy fulfillment. And of course Hebrews is chock full of that kind of stuff with type and anti-type and so forth. So sometimes it's said that Hebrews is sort of less historical, less eschatological than the other New Testament writings. And I don't think that's true at all. I think from the very opening sentence, the writer to the Hebrews wants us to think in terms of salvation history, right? And God made both the present evil age and he made the age to come. And if you do a word study of Ion in Hebrews, it occurs about a dozen times. I looked at it this morning. sometimes it's in this phrase, kind of like le'olam, Dave, in Hebrew, which just means forever, right? And you get eis tous aionas in Greek, which is often like often quoting Psalm 110 about Melchizedek in chapter 7, right? Hebrews does have the same essential framework of God at work bringing history to its fulfillment as the rest of the New Testament. So, thus far the first sentence in Hebrews 1 and 2. Questions? Comments? Anything at all? Again, when I ask these rhetorical questions like, I don't know why the translations do this, it's completely possible there's a good reason that I just don't know about. Because what I know about Hebrews would rattle around in a relatively small container. But it does puzzle me sometimes. So I think it should be translated ages. As also, by the way, in the Creed, the life of the age to come. Right? It's Ion. Right? And now I'm poised to make a big speech about eschatology, but I'm not going to do it. See, and I know you find that hard to believe. But I want to get to this next remarkable sentence. So, unless there's questions about 1 and 2. Anything? Okay. All right, now let's look up vocabulary time. Verse 3, it actually goes verses 3 and 4 is one sentence. So I guess we'll do the whole thing and then we'll try to put the pieces together. Hus on ap augasma tes duxes kai kara krete tes hypostasios autu. Pheron te tapanta to hremate tes dynameos autu. Katharismon ton hamarteon poie samenas. Are you ready for a main verb now? Ekathism. En dexia tes megalozines en hypseilois. Tas uto kreton genamenas ton angelon. Hazo diaphoroteron par autus kecleron name ken anima. Did you get all that? This is great. Okay, we start with a relative pronoun, who, right? Okay, fair enough. That refers to the son. And on, anybody, can you spot what that might be? Second word? Yeah, it's the participle of amen. Very good. And we'll weasel it for now. Who, being, now ap augasma is one of those words that I had to look up, and it means radiance. Oh, this is a great English word. Effulgence. Reflection. Okay. I think next time I razz the refs, I'm going to accuse them of too much effulgence in their calls. Yeah. So we'll go with radiance. Who, being the radiance of glory, and now karakrate is another one of these words you have to look up. It means impress, reproduction, representation, distinctive mark, outward aspect, outward appearance, form. It's often rendered representation, I think, or something like that. Or imprint. Who, being the radiance of glory and imprint of the being or the nature of him. And now we have another participle. Without warning, the little word ta, as you might remember, that follows pheron, is postpositive. So you can actually put ta in front of pheron. And it links the two participial constructions. So you've got on, blah, 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 te, pheron, blah, blah, blah. Okay? And pheron, of course, is the present participle from pharaoh, right? It means to carry or bear. So now we're still talking about who, right? And who bearing or carrying all things, sometimes translated upholding, all things, and now we have a dative of means, by the word of his power. Okay? And now we have another participle, this time aorist. These other first two participles, own and pharaon, or present stem. And now at the end of the next line, we have poie samenas, which is the aorist participle middle of poieo. Okay? It's the only time a middle form of poieo occurs in Hebrews. I looked it up. I don't know if it has any force or not. Making katharismon, cleansing of or purification of sins. And now we finally get the main verb, ekathizen, from kathizo. He sat. Okay? And the he is the hus, which refers to the son. He sat at the right of the majesty. And where did he sit? In the highest places, in the highest things. And now, we have more participles. Actually, one more participle. The awkward thing for me about verse 4 is you have to get the tas uto, and see the little word below it, huso? You got to take that together. And according to the lexicon, it translates something like this. It'd be like a dative of means. By so much, blah, 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 than, blah, blah, blah. So it's a comparative construction. All right? So doing it kind of woodenly. By so much, now we have kratone. Now you get a free dessert if you can tell me what kratone is.
Comparative?
Will gets a free dessert, but he's in training. Yeah, it's actually from agathos. Good. And it means better of all things, right? By so much better becoming of the angels, but because kratone is a comparative, you would say better than. This is the dreaded genitive of comparison, okay? By so much becoming greater than the angels, than or as. And now we look for a verb in the when the other shoe drops in the comparison, and the verb is kekleronomekon, which is the perfect of kleronomel, which means to inherit. As he inherited a name. Now, what sort of name? You see, diaphoroteron, it's an adjective, and it is from diapharos, which means outstanding or something that matters. We actually get our word adiaphora. That's where it doesn't matter. Well, a diapharos is something that does matter. Okay, you just take the alpha privative off of it. And this comparative, it's another comparative, it means more different, more outstanding or excellent. So as, and believe it or not, it has to modify anima. Why is it separated from anima by three words, and why is it in front? And the answer is because of the devil, right? And because of the way Greek works. So putting that verse 4 together kind of in a whole piece, after he had by as much become greater than the angels, as he has inherited a more outstanding name, par plus the accusative can be than them, than they. Okay. Now, if you had to diagram this sentence, I mean, it'd take you a week, right? But let's back up and try to put it together. And I want to maybe give these first two participles in verse 3, own and pharaoh, in a causal sense. And then the poiesamenos, a temporal one. Okay? So it might conceivably be translated something like this. Who, because he is the radiance, the glorious radiance, and the imprint of his being, and because he upholds all things by the word, by his powerful word, or the word of his power, after he had made cleansing of sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majestic one, or the right hand of majesty, in the highest places, after he had become by as much greater than the angels, as he has inherited a name which is more outstanding than theirs. Isn't that a great sentence? And by the way, that's all, in a sense, verses 1 through 4 is the sentence, because hus, verses 3 and 4, is all a relative clause. It all is hus. Again, this is called a period. Greek loves to subordinate, you know, have one main verb and then subordinate a bunch of stuff, and this is doing that on spades. The only comparable example here is actually Luke 1:1-4. You know, the introduction and also the beginning of Acts, you get the same kind of a thing, but this is worse than that. Joe?
What is the auto in verse 3 at the end there?
What is it? It's an inspired Greek word. Yeah, auto at the end of verse 3.
That?
Which one?
The kupas that set O's out to in the middle there.
Yep.
What is that referring to?
So the being the imprint of the nature of Him. The antecedent is probably God, the Father.
Okay.
Right. And all of the you know, one of the very really interesting things about Hebrews is its Christology. You cannot find a higher Christology any place in the New Testament. See? You know, you read Hebrews and you go, oh, Jesus is God. And in the same letter, you get statements like, He learned obedience. He became greater. So it's a really interesting combination. And if you read all of Hebrews, you end up with something very much like Nicaea. Or Chalcedon, that's where we get it, yeah.
Right. It's not really the answer to the gospel, right?
Well, that's another question, yeah, right. By that time, it wasn't regarded as such. And as you probably know, I try to remember now, I can't remember, Chloe would know, because he's our big expert on all these important things. I can't remember, I think it was in the East. No, I can't remember. It was either in the East or the West that Hebrews was not as widely known, and there were some questions raised about it, apparently, so... Yeah. So, and all of this, by the way, starting in the middle of verse 2 with hun, whom, through whom, and who, all of that is describing Son. Right? So we need to say something about the Son here. We're going to start this letter, most people regard it as a sermon. But we're going to start it by saying a remarkable amount of stuff about the Son. And apparently it's important for the writer to the Hebrews and his audience that the Son be superior, blindingly superior, to the angels. Because that's what he goes on to talk about next. See? So this is a big agenda item for him. Will?
This word, hupseilois,
mm-hmm.
Is that the heights or the highest places?
I think it's normally translated... Well, I don't know. Hypsilos just means exalted, right? I mean, it's just an adjective. It's just an adjective, yeah. And hypsao mean in John is to lift up, right? So it's not a superlative form, right? So probably literally just in the high places, yeah. In the heights probably would be the best way to do it, right?
Okay.
So good. Okay, man, we've already done a day's work. Any other questions? It actually gets a little easier. So I thought I'd get at least one more verse so that you won't give up. I've actually worked through this before. It took me a while to figure out what the heck I was doing. So, all right, and so now we get this angel, this angelic comparison, right? And again, why this is so important to the writer of the Hebrews, we don't exactly know, right? Because we don't know the zitzim leben of the letter. Verse 5. Tinegar a pen pateton angelon, huyasmu e su ego semeron gegenekasa, kai palan ego esamai auto ace patera, kai autas estai moi ace huyan. Now that's pretty easy, and we can do that, and then we'll stop. Tine, you can see from the accent, let me ask as a question, what kind of word is this, tine? It is the interrogative pronoun, dative singular. To whom? Right? For, to whom said he, did he say formerly, of the angels? So you have to take tone angelon with tine. For to whom of the angels ever did he say, and now he quotes the first of a string of Old Testament citations, and this is from Psalm 2, verse 7, as you can see from the side reference. You are the Son of me. I today have begotten you, Psalm 2, verse 7. And so the writer to the Hebrews is saying, look, this is addressed to the Son, not to the angels, right? Kai Pollen, and again, SMI is just the deponent future from Amit, right? I will be to him unto a father. This is a Septuagintalism, right? It's la, it's haya la in the Septuagintal Greek. So I will be to, or I will be for. So you don't really have to translate the ace. You can just say, I will be to him a father, right? And, now the same construction is repeated, he himself will be to me unto a son, or he will be a son to me, right? And again, now that's the citation from 2 Samuel 7, verse 14. Now, I mean, the writer to the Hebrews is just going to, I have no idea how people could listen to this, if this is a homily. I mean, this is a more, these people have really large eardrums or something. It's just, the stuff just comes at you in waves. And so it really is a, invites a, some thought as to how, and of course I don't have any experience with an oral culture. Even today there are oral cultures where they don't catch anything with their eyes. They catch everything with their ears. So, anyway. Okay, questions about verse 5. That part's not so bad. After that opening period, you get some shorter stuff. Will?
About, is this a Septuagintalism also, the fact that it's in the dative after the to-be verb? You see...
yeah, he will be to me.
To him and to me. Is that regular Greek construction right there?
That's a good question, actually. He will be to me. See, sometimes that can just... express possession, right? As also in Hebrew. And this would be the dative of possession. In other words, you could translate, I will have him as a son. Mm-hmm. That's a good question. If I had to guess an answer, and it'd be only a guess, I would call it, they make this distinction between Septuagintal Greek having primary Semitisms and secondary Semitisms. Mm-hmm. Primary Semitism basically doesn't make any sense in Greek. A secondary Semitism is something that you could do in Greek.
It's very rare.
But you wouldn't do it as often as the Septuagint or the New Testament do it. If I had to guess, and again, Dr. Vels actually would be able to give a much more informed answer because he's actually done some research in this area and written on it, I would guess it's probably a secondary Semitism. So you could do it in Greek, but it wouldn't be common. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. It would be like... yeah, like the way you and I tend to write Greek sentences. You know, if we ever sit down to write a Greek sentence, we write it like an English speaker would write it. Not necessarily like a Greek person would. So.
That's good, we're not Greek.
I'm not Greek, so. Okay, hey, we got 5 verses of Hebrews 1 done. I mean, this, we ought to get a medal for this, so I'll talk to somebody about that.